Hey everyone, welcome to the Grief Informed Podcast. I'm your host, Rachel Garcia, and this is a place where I bring you authentic conversations with people who are willing to share their journey through seasons of grief. No matter your cultural upbringing, societal conditioning, or faith practice, grief affects us all. Whether you're dealing with a loss, a diagnosis, a broken heart, or the everyday stressors of life, or love someone who is, these conversations are here to support you in that process. So be sure to check out the show notes for potential trigger warnings. And whether you're very comfortable with or deeply avoidant of grief and its many responses, you are welcome here. Thank you for being here, and now on to the episode. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Grief Informed Podcast. I'm your host, Rachel Garcia. And today I have with me Amanda McCoy Flanagan. She's a native New Yorker turned Coloradan, author, podcaster, energy healer, and certified intuitive grief coach. Amanda recently released her award-winning inspirational memoir, Trust Yourself to Be All In, Safe to Love and Let Go. She's the co-host of the Soul Rising podcast and co-founder of the nonprofit organization Castle Rock Clubhouse, which is a recovery clubhouse that serves as meeting space for various 12-step programs. Amanda is passionate about sobriety, meditation, and spirituality. Thank you for being here, Amanda.
Thank you so much for having me, Rachel. It's so good to be with you.
Yes, we've covered that we have the New York, the North and the South. We are covering all the bases, your accent, my accent. This will be a fun time.
It's great. It's going to be great.
Yeah. Yes, it is. Awesome. Okay. So for those listening, Amanda reached out and told me she had a story that we would want to hear, that I would want to hear. So the story being that how grief from your brother's death saved your marriage after almost ruining it. And I said, yes, that's definitely a story I want to hear. And so before we dive into that, can you tell us a little bit about your cultural upbringing and background?
Sure. So I'm from New York. I grew up on Long Island, the South Shore of Long Island. My family is mainly Italian. The Italian is the culture, I guess, that guided and drove a lot of our traditions and just the way that we lived life. We used to do, you know, every Sunday we'd go over to my grandma's house in Queens, New York, and have a big dinner. And, you know, holidays were always a really, really big deal with a lot of food and a lot of drinking. And we just were full, you know, I say in my book, we fought hard and we loved hard. You know, that's just how a lot of Italians, a lot of families, you know, different cultures do it. But I'm a New Yorker through and through. That's basically my cultural background is being a New Yorker. And so much so that when I moved to Colorado, I actually had like my second, I'm sober a while and I've had like three emotional breakdowns in recovery. And I had like my second one because I was so tied into being a New Yorker. My identity was so wrapped up in being a New Yorker, and people carry a lot of pride about that. You know, there's a joke. How do you know somebody's from New York? They'll tell you in the first 5 minutes. You know? People are very proud of that. Mm-hmm. I am too. You know, I have a little street cred. You know, I have street smarts and something like grit. You know, it kind of makes it a little gritty. You know, you got to kind of like get on the bus or get run over by it type of deal, right? So you got to show up and it's a dog eat dog, you know, stuff like that. But I moved out here and it was just like, who am I? Because I had even just like, I mean, I guess anybody who moves, who's lived somewhere for 35 years would have that experience because you get so used to just your surroundings, your environment, the same stores you shop in, the same friends you have, who your friends have a big, you know, influence on who you are. I came to find that out because when I moved here and I didn't really know anybody, I was like, who am I? Like, how do I show up? Like I had nothing, like no guidepost to like show me like how I was supposed to act. Yeah. And that was a huge revelation. That was a really painful time too, because it was like, okay, well now I can be who I really am and how am I showing up? So I got to sort of not even reinvent myself, just invent myself because I really never knew who I was. I really didn't. I was sober 9 years at this point and I still didn't know who I was.
Yeah. Yeah, you've been in Colorado how long?
9 years.
Nine years. Okay. Yeah. I'm curious what your biggest culture shock was when you moved to the West from New York.
People being nice. Nice people was probably the biggest culture shock for me.
Okay, let's hold on. I need context. What do you consider being nice that was shocking?
So I use the example a lot of like being in the supermarket, like, you know, going up, or in any store, going up to somebody and being like, well, first of all, looking each other in the eye and like acknowledging each other. Like that's number one, just acknowledging other humans was very different. And then when like you ask somebody, well, where's the bread, for example, right? And you ask like the guy in produce, you know, and he like, I say this in my book too, he like drops his apples and like walks you like immediately, like no, like not like, oh, give me a second. Like it's like, oh, it's on aisle two and let's go. And I'm like, oh no, that's okay. Like I got it. You know, it just felt weird. It was like, why are you escorting me to the bread aisle? You know, it was just so strange. But so nice.
Yeah. Have you been to the South yet?
To the South? Just Florida. Just Florida.
No, that's the northern. That's still a northern state. I mean, it's just transplants. Y'all are just going down there. That's not – I'm sorry to my Floridian friends, but I think they would agree, like, that's hard to say that's the South. You've got to come visit me in Birmingham. And then,
you're the real deal.
Yeah, we're the real deal. Yeah. We'll wave at you in our car. Do they do this in Colorado where they wave from the steering wheel?
Yeah. Yeah. We wave to each other, but it depends. It's not, it's more often not than yeah. Like usually I'm the one like waving and my friend, my kids are like, do you know that person? And I'm like, no, I'm just waving because like, why not? Because that feels good, you know?
Yeah, that's interesting. I love that. Okay, so do you know your Enneagram number?
Well, yes, I just found out today because you and I were talking about it and you helped me. And I found it and I read it and it was like, one other thing was like, you think you're always right. And I was like, no, that can't be me. That's definitely not me.
Definitely no.
Turns out it is. So it's Enneagram number one. I definitely don't think I'm always right, but if I'm being completely honest, I do think that I have a very logical kind of practical, smart, blended with that. When I say pragmatic and spiritual, I feel like I have like a really good grasp on things.
I think
that sounds egotistical or not, but
no, those are all great strengths. You can say your strengths. Yeah. And the one being, I know it said the reformer, but it's also known as a perfectionist, which I like to reframe as, what did I say? It wasn't the perfectionist, more of the principled. Like there's a sense of wanting to do it right the first time. Like there's efficiency in place for the one. The ones are the ones that want to keep us on task and doing it right, doing it correctly, creating efficiencies for everybody. I think
that's me.
The ones are the ones that keep us in line. Like they really are great leaders in that way of keeping us on task and keeping us with what we are here to do. So yeah, that makes sense.
I just want to like get everything out of life. Like I don't want to like waste time. And like I said, I'm like the queen of efficiency. And you were like, oh yeah, that's the hallmark. Like that's it. That's definitely one. I just feel like it's a waste of time if I have to spend extra time doing something when I could just do it right the first time. I don't do everything right the first time, but at least at least give it my best effort so that I can move on to the next thing and just kind of squeeze more out of life.
Right. Absolutely. That's a gift to the rest of us who need that. And namely, I'm raising my hand. I love the ones in my world. They definitely contribute some beautiful like inspiration for just getting things done and doing it well. Like that is truly, that's a one. Yeah.
What are you?
I'm a two. I'm an Enneagram two.
Okay.
Yeah. We're the.
And that was my winged one, right? You said that was a wing.
Yes. A one wing two is what you tested. Yeah. And then, I think based on your results, but the I'm a two wing three and we're the helper. We're the ones that get the love of helping others, serving others, or wanting to connect with others is a big, deep drive. Yeah. So that's one of the, but when we go to stress, we're the challenger. So we become very, I told you, ones go to four, become a little more moody.
Yeah. Which I used in a nice expletive to explain that instead, but we're going to go with moody.
Moody, yeah. Reframe to moody. And yeah, and I'm reframing to aggressive. Well, aggressive is, maybe that's the right way.
It's assertive.
Like assertive. Thank you. We become way more assertive, but sometimes it can be from a lens of frustration and anger. And so the work is to be able to be assertive without that. Boundaried is a great way to say that. Twos need to work on boundaries. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And sevens are invited to work toward their seven, which is the playful and spontaneous, and to release the need for everything to be efficient and perfect and allow others to make mistakes, allow yourself to make mistakes so that you can lean more into the spontaneity and playfulness. Yeah.
Yeah. I definitely need more of that. Definitely. Yeah. Need to be able to just like chill out sometimes and just like have fun, and you don't always have to be doing, I'm sure we're very much like do, you know,
I'm really trying to just be. You're in the most amazing scenery in the land to be able to be playful and have fun out there in Colorado.
Yeah. They call America's playground, right? Yeah. So there's so much to explore. During COVID, we were home a lot because my husband has 9/11 respiratory related illness. Mm-hmm. So COVID was like serious for us, and our kids were e-learners. So he and I would like take breaks every other Friday, and I would go out and explore. And I found so many great places by myself. I would just hike around, and it was really a beautiful time of growth. And I'll get into that more when I tell my story. But yeah, Colorado is just beautiful. It's just amazing. It's just a great energy here.
It is. Well, and that's a great segue. So tell us, how did you get into where you are today and the work that you're doing, the book, the memoir? What started for you?
So I had a lot of loss. At first, when I was 8 months sober, I had a boyfriend who died. He overdosed, which put him into, put him into a diabetic coma. So that was in like April of 2007. And I met my now husband in July of 2007. Mm. I didn't give myself, my first date was in September. I gave myself about 5 months. Mm. And I wasn't in therapy. I wasn't really doing any grief, healing or work or anything. I didn't know like that it even existed. It wasn't like language that I was, privy to. Like I just didn't have any experience with grief, because when anybody in my family died, like my grandparents had died up until that point when I was a teenager, it wasn't really talked about. It wasn't there was no process. It wasn't like, well, how do you feel about this? Right. So I just didn't know what to do with that. So I just kind of cried for a while and just kind of tried to move on. And, so I met my husband, and we, got married a few years later, had a couple of kids, moved out to Colorado in 2015. And that's when I say everybody started dying. That was, it was like my aunt was first. She was a month after we moved here. Then my other aunt, my mom's first cousin, who I was close with as well, my first cousin. And then my brother passed away 4 months after my closest cousin.
Wow.
And both of them from drugs. And, once my brother died, it all came up. It all came up. I hadn't done any grief work or therapy or anything. I wasn't in therapy at all. And I kind of knew I should have been. My marriage was suffering a little bit. And I actually kept saying, let's go to marriage counseling. And we just never did it. And then when my brother died, it just all came up, and I just could not stuff it back in the box. It just like blew up. So for the 3 months after my brother's death, all I could do really was just lay in bed, cry, take a bath, and go to my recovery meetings, which I'm really grateful, really, really grateful that's where I wanted to be. That was the only place I wanted to be. It was the only place I felt safe. I felt safe crying. I felt safe letting it out and sharing, and people were comforting me. So about 2 months after that, again, 5 months, that 5 month mark. So my boyfriend Mike dies when I'm 8 months sober. 5 months later, I meet my husband. 5 months after my brother's death, I'm at a concert, Pearl Jam, which is my favorite band, and mine and my brother's band. My brother's name was Jeremy, and we just had this real connection of this band. And I'm standing there in the crowd, and the song Better Man comes on, and the lyrics are, she lies and says she's in love with him, can't find a better man. And something about those lyrics, it hit me. And I was like, wait a minute, why? I shut this song off every time it's on the radio. Like, why do I shut this song off? Is it because I've heard it a million times? But I don't shut off any other song that I've heard a million times. I don't shut off Alive or even Flo or Jeremy. You know, I don't, why do I shut this off? And it became very apparent to me that, or what I thought was true, and I'll get into this in a minute, that I didn't love my husband, that I had been lying to myself the whole time. So I come and mind you, so then the people that I'm with and the people that I'm around, I'm feeling this like deep connection to like all of them. And it was just like, why don't I feel this authentic and this comfortable around my own husband? Like there was just something blocking us. So I come home and I tell him, I don't love you. I don't think I ever loved you. I think my decision to marry you was just a very good decision on my part. All my friends were getting married. You know, I was around 30 years old. They were starting to have babies. You know, it was just, he was a really great catch. He is a really great catch. And I felt like lucky, you know, I felt like, what does this guy want with me? I was only a year sober, you know, so I had this whole story going in my head. And, we didn't know. He was like, what? Like, what are you telling me? Like, what are you saying? Like, where is this coming from? You know? And I was like, I don't know. I don't think I love you. And he was like, all right. So after like a day or two, he was like, listen, he's like, your brother just died. He goes, five months ago. He's like, do you think maybe your grief is playing a part in this?
Maybe. Like,
could it possibly be? And of course, Enneagram one, I guess. I'm like, no, no, no. I'm right.
Yeah.
I believe this is true. You're wrong. I'm right. It's not my grief. This is how I feel, you know. So I was like, but you know what? And we were like in anxiety, like this, it was terrible. It was like one of the most terrible months, if not aside from my brother's death, like those months, like just like terrible, terrible month, like anxiety, just, it was just so bad. And we had no idea what to do. And I actually had started therapy right after my brother died. I had an appointment with this woman scheduled for the week my brother died. He was still alive. I had made the appointment, and turns out, so I canceled, and I told her I had to go home, and I said, can I see you when I get back? And she said, yeah. She goes, well, I'm a grief counselor and a couples counselor. Like, so she just knew all of this, because then I went back to her and I said, I think I need to come in with my husband, right? So she was like, well, yeah, it turns out I'm also a couples counselor. So it was really, really amazing how that all worked out. So we go, I'm willing to go because now I'm sober. I'm 12 years sober at this time. And mind you, I was doing all the work. You know, anybody out there who's listening and who's in recovery, I wasn't just sitting on my laurels. Like I was doing the work. I was in the steps. I was sponsoring people. I had my sponsor. Like I was in therapy actually when I got engaged. I was there for about 2 years. So it's not like I hadn't been self-reflecting. It wasn't like I've been like running from myself. But I always say, you don't know what you don't know until you know it. Like it had to be revealed, and certain layers had to be peeled before this big thing I could actually face it and see it. And it's just strange how life does that. And that's what grief does. Grief just like brings stuff up that without your consent, really, just like shows up like, oh, yeah. Okay, there you are. You know, I don't really want to see you, but I guess I got to look at this, right? So she, you know, we were in therapy for about a year and a half, then COVID hit and we did some work on our own. But that whole journey of counseling with my husband, it really, you know, just unlocked my self-worth, my self-love, my value, everything, my independence in a way, you know, this kind of like self-sufficiency, taking care of myself, like the fear went away of being alone. So that was basically what it was. So my husband's 12 years older. I said he's, you know, chronically ill from 9/11. I was in such pain and despair when my brother died that my brain convinced me, our brains are just so marvelous, like what they can do. It's just wild. Protected me. And said, you're never going to have to feel that pain again. So let's just grieve Jim now. Let's just like your marriage, let's just get it all done right now so that like you're not going to have to feel this later when he dies. And of course, that's not logical. Grief isn't logical. That's right. Like grief is just its own animal and it does not make sense. So I was able to see through with my therapist's help, through looking at my relationships with my parents, through looking at just my history and the way that I'd operated through my whole life, basically up until this point, I'm 38 years old, that I'd been living with this limiting belief, which I call the great myth. And the great myth is that everybody leaves me, everybody hurts me, everybody dies. Yeah, people do die, but untimely, like through, you know, my brother's death, you know, made that true. So I had been living with that story.
And all the cousins and the extended family. Yes. You had just seen death over and over again. Yeah.
And then finally, when the big one hit, when it was my brother, it was like, you know what? They're right. And when I say they, it's my family. It's the generational dysfunctional message that was passed down through the lineage, which I'm sure back in the day when like, you know, I use this example in my book, like, you know, dad's off at war and mom has like 8 kids that she has to keep alive. She doesn't have time to feel. She doesn't have time to grieve. She's got to keep these kids alive and healthy and herself, right? Yeah. She's more worried about where's my next meal coming from? How do I, you know, keep the house, you know, free of termites or whatever, right? Like she's got bigger fish to fry and she can't just like lay around and cry and feel her pain because there's also that fear of like, well, you know, what if I never get up or, you know, how are we going to survive? I'm the only one that these kids are relying on. Right. So there's a lot of that. And it's just how it was. We just didn't talk about emotions back in the day, even through, you know, until kind of like now, I feel like in the last decade or so, it's been like this, like burst of like, let's go there. Let's talk about it. Let's really feel. You know, and all we just didn't have the tools maybe before. So if you don't have the tools, you're kind of afraid to open up that Pandora's box.
Yeah.
So, So we do this therapy and, you know, the greatest thing she said to me was, well, she said so many great things, but one of the things she said, I think it was on our first session of marriage counseling, she said, you need to get whole, meaning me, and you need to get whole, meaning my husband, and then you need to find a third whole together. So was sort of this permission to like stop being so enmeshed. You know, I based my value so much on what my husband thought of me, right? Like, you know, like when you meet somebody and you like pretend that like you like all these things that like you really don't, but you just want to look adventurous. So you just want to feel like, well, if they like that, maybe I can like that. Or like, or you're just trying to find commonalities. You're just trying to find things to do, whatever, you know, to bond really. So, I realized I had done a whole ton of that and didn't think so at all. I thought I was like good to go. I was like, I'm sober. I'm great. I know myself. And, you know, and looking back, I was not there. I was not ready at all to be in a real serious relationship like that. But so what it came down to was this fear of loss that I think so many of us live with, and it creates this fear of intimacy. Where we lack vulnerability. And I would say many divorces result because of this. I would be very curious someday to do like a study on like midlife crisis, right? And that happens, you know, and then maybe somebody's parent dies around that time. That's kind of the age where we're thinking about the rest of our lives and I'm going to die someday and I want to make the best out of my life, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I think it comes down to communication and really just like kind of bearing your soul and trusting yourself that you have your own back no matter who stays or leaves. That's what it comes down to. That, you know, hopefully my husband sticks around for a lot longer, but God forbid something happens to him soon, you know, I'll hit the floor for a while. I'll probably have another breakdown or I'll be back in therapy. Like, yeah, it won't be pretty, but I know that I will survive and I will call on the people, the friends, the professionals. My higher power really is a huge part of this. Spirituality is a huge part of this for me. Knowing that I'm really truly never alone and that I will always get back up because I have that desire to live and that desire to survive and that grit to just face whatever pain I have to. That's the beauty of going through like harrowing pain is like, you know, not a lot can measure up to that. Like, no matter what comes in the future, like, I feel like I've already seen it. I've already walked through the darkness.
Yeah.
I've already gone there, that I'm not afraid of it anymore.
Right. What was it that shifted that story for you? There was, when you said, you know, this feeling of all, everybody always leaves, everybody that the Dewey Freeman says that we process our pain through the levels of early childhood development, and that sense of like, is the world is safe? Am I safe in the world? What can I do in the world? How well can I do it? And then who am I? And so this sense of the world's not safe, everybody leaves. It's a very young part of our childhood. How did you shift that and reframe that to a place where you could function and move forward?
So knowing that a lot of the things that happened to me were not my fault and did not mean that I was unlovable or unworthy. It's really truly finding that like unshakable foundation of self-worth and self-love through healing some of the trauma. So I had a sexual trauma when I was about 5 years old and another one when I was about 7. And then just different things that had happened. My father cheated on my mother when she had breast cancer. I was about 16 years old. He wound up leaving 5 years later. My mother also just didn't really know how to process emotions very well. She really didn't know how to help my brother and I. We were both kind of falling off the rails at that time when we were teenagers. But just the messages that I got, I think the way I reframe it is just through the lens of compassion, that whatever they were going through really had nothing to do with me and that they really did do the best that they could. I really believe that. My husband said that to me a long time ago, years and years ago. He said, you know, people do the best they can. And I said, no, they don't. I said, she could have done better. He could have done better. Many people in my life could have done better. And now I see it completely different. I really do believe that nobody wants to hurt their children. Nobody wants to hurt anybody, you know, unless you're like a psychopath, you know, but like they did the best that they could with what they knew. And so I don't blame anybody for anything. I do believe everything, and this is also another way I deal with this is, or I've come through the other side, is everything that happened to me, I believe happened on purpose and for a reason, and that I chose. I believe in reincarnation. I believe that I not necessarily chose that, like, okay, my brother is going to die, but chose to be willing to go through whatever pain I have to go through to heal this major life lesson, this thing that I came back and said, okay, you know, yeah, I'm going to do it this time, because in a past life, maybe I didn't, you know, maybe, you know, I'm sober, I'm an alcoholic. So maybe I drank myself to death in a past life over some kind of loss, right? Like, who knows? So now it's like, okay, I have to accept that these things happened to me and I have to look through the lens of compassion and say that nobody necessarily did this stuff to me, but rather my soul chose these things for the lessons for me to grow and to heal. And you know, however severe that has to be for me, it's okay, because that's the deeper healing I'm gonna do, right? Like, the lower I go, the higher I bounce. That's just like how it works for me. The more pain I'm in, I know what's waiting on the other side. And it's just like this exponential growth that happens.
And that is a hopefulness for you. A hopefulness of that growth is what would help keep you in it when you're feeling the depths of it, of loss or pain. There's a hopefulness for you. I love that.
Exactly.
Curious, when you approach your husband, which I love that he's like, maybe, I don't know, I'm no expert, but maybe your grief is showing up here, which was, again, speaking of compassion, and then the willingness that he had to work with you through that is phenomenal. And I love how you piece together. It doesn't go unnoticed to me that how much excavating you had to do to get to the place where you recognized that your brain was trying to preemptively grieve. So you would now and just go ahead and remove the relationship so that you would hurt now and not later. And it's, oh my goodness, you're right. The brain is amazing.
Crazy.
Yeah. So what was his take on it? What was his, because he's also watching, not only he's lost these members of the family as well and has his grief. How did all of that affect his own process and y'all navigating that together, grief together?
So my husband is also sober. So he is 10 years more sobriety than me. So at this point I had 12 years, he had 22 years. So he also knew that whatever's presenting on the surface is probably not what's going on underneath. And we try to live by spiritual principles, which are patience, understanding, love, kindness, compassion, right? So, and he loved me enough and he saw the pain that I was in. And he was willing as well to look. And he also knew that he wasn't completely innocent, if that's the right word, in this whole thing. Because I had been asking him for a long time, we need to go to marriage counseling. Like, I'm not happy. Like, there's something like not right here. So he kind of, and he has PTSD, which miraculously, I mean, I want to say like he had PTSD because he's just like so much better. Like, yes, yeah, so there's moments here and there where I can see it, but it's like where it was like a 10 before, it's like a 2. Like, it's just, so he did EMDR, he did something called rapid resolution therapy, which is a type of hypnotherapy. His brain is rewired, which is the way that you heal trauma,
right?
Like PTSD. So he knew that he contributed to some of this, maybe. Like, he was open to investigating that, to say, well, what's my part? So that's our whole deal in the 12 steps in recovery is what's my part in this? How did I contribute to this? So it always takes two to tango, right? So like, he knew that there was something that he probably should look at too. And, you know, in the course of this, it was just such a beautiful experience. He did have to go back through some of his grief. You know, he had to look at the death of his father. He had to look at 9/11, you know, and all that pain and all that grief and those being a fireman showing up in different, you know, they don't just get called to fires, you know, they get called to, you know, decapitations, you know, they get called to like car accidents, like just crazy, crazy things that he's seen. So he was sort of forced into doing his work, because I had been telling him for years, you know, it's getting worse, your PTSD is getting worse. He finally admitted it in 2016, 2017. So he'd been a fireman since like the 90s. So he was living with that for a long time and sort of denying it. And we just, like, I didn't know what it was and neither did he. He didn't really want to admit it or see it. But I would see, you know, how my children would start reacting. You know, they'd get very nervous, you know, if they spilt a glass of water, it would be like, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. You know, like overreacting, over-exaggerating, you know, stuff like that. So I would say to him, like, this isn't okay. Like, look at what we're doing. And me too. I have anxiety too. Our anxiety kind of fed off of each other. And that's what we learned as well in counseling, that I basically chose him. I sensed these unconscious traits. And this is a whole other topic. It's called Imago. It's called Imago relationship therapy. And it's a whole deal. Yeah.
Yes, right?
And
it's amazing.
So I knew that somewhere I sensed he wasn't going to like push me into this emotionally intimate place that I was afraid of. And he was also anxious. So my anxiety wasn't going to be a turnoff, or, you know, there were things that I couldn't see on the surface, but we subconsciously sensed these traits. It's really wild. So, you know, I kept saying, you know, your talk therapy is not helping, you know, because he was talking to somebody, but it just seemed to be getting worse and worse. So through this process, you know, and I thank him all the time, like, thank you for like sticking this out with me, because like, that's got to be really, really hard to hear. Really, really hurtful. I don't love you. And the way that I went about it was not very nice. It wasn't very nice. Right. Again, I guess the stress, right? The stress, Enneagram, the stress comes out in the excessive moodiness. And I wasn't very nice about it. I remember in one of the sessions, my therapist was like, because like I was letting it all fly in therapy. I was just like saying whatever I felt. And she was like, no. She goes, you need to stop. She goes, do you know how hurtful that is to hear that? You're not allowed to do that, Amanda. And she like put me in my place. And I was like, okay. All right. You know, so we've both grown tremendously. And, you know, I don't know if we would have healed and gotten to the place where we are today without having to be in that immense amount of pain. But I'm just grateful. I'm just so grateful that he stuck around and that he did his work. And I tell him all the time, I say, thank you. Thank you for doing your work. Because if you didn't do your work, this would not have been, I wouldn't have stuck around. Like, no matter what I was going through, like I deserve to be treated well. My kids deserve to be, and he was always kind and nice. He wasn't like a mean guy. He just had PTSD and he would just get like overreact over things, you know? So we both grew a lot in the process.
Right. And this is an invitation to those listening that might have PTSD or know that they've been in situations where they've experienced very traumatic situations and aren't. This is the beautiful invitation to check in with those that you love to see if maybe they see the effects of that, because it could be affecting the relationships and you being able to, for him, that being part of his process is recognizing his side of the street included, hey, I could navigate this a little better with some assistance and support. And then that helped both of you. That's powerful. So you guys go through that and then you start moving into like wanting to be of service to others. You have a book that you write and that leads you into the work that you're currently doing with others. And tell me about what it is that you love to do and from your story, what you've learned, what you're wanting to offer to others.
So I have a social work degree. I have a master's in social work. And I thought that I would go into the social work field. Right during COVID, we all kind of, many people anyway, were questioning their purpose and, you know, how am I going to live the rest of my days, all that kind of stuff. Once I can get out of my house, what am I going to do with my life, right? And so I thought I'd go into the social work field. And I was running on my treadmill one day and I just got struck with this like knowing, like, you're going to write a book. And I'm very close to spirit. I don't know if it was my brother or a guide or whatever, but I felt like I knew you're going to write a book. And I was like, what? I'm an English major, journalism minor. So like it kind of, you know, matches up. I had been thinking about, what's my education? What am I passionate about? And what are my natural abilities? And I was like, I want to put those three things together to try and figure out what I'm supposed to do, you know, in life. Because I've always felt like I had a bigger mission, a bigger purpose. And so the book, you know, it was like, okay, well, now you've had all this healing and all this experience, and now you need to show other people. I think that's why we go through pain, is to then help other people through it, be there for each other. And so I start my podcast. I write my book, I put my book out, and I start, I'm starting to do, like, I've been doing workshops, I do grief groups, I do things like that to help other people address their limiting beliefs, basically, these things, these fears that are kind of running our lives, and some may be unconscious, and we don't even realize they're there. I do a lot of spiritual work, energy work through meditation. I do breath work on my own. I don't actually do that. I'm holding a retreat actually in Colorado at the end of September, and we're going to be doing a lot of that. I'm level 1 and 2 Reiki certified practitioner. I have all this stuff in law. I'm also a certified intuitive grief coach. So I have all these pieces in place and I actually have not yet like rolled it out. Like that's coming.
It's coming.
I was going to start in September, but we're going to Italy in October as a family. So we're going to be gone for a long time. Yeah. I'm like, I cannot wait. I cannot wait for that.
Yeah.
So I'm like, I'm gonna just kind of start my business launch in November. So I'll be able to offer, you know, a lot of healing work. I'm also in like a psychic mediumship course where like I'm also learning to tap into like the other side and what's beyond the veil and do some readings in that way, past life, stuff like that. So I'm kind of creating this like package, if you will, of these like services that I'm going to be able to offer people. So it's just building things. I'm just kind of building one thing on top of the other. And it all started with my book, and it all started really from my brother's death. You know, I always say grief is a gift, and that's really hard for people to hear that are in acute grief. But my brother really, I don't know if he's doing it from the other side or I've just got really, really motivated, but like I've finally decided to step into who I truly am. I have a picture hanging in my kitchen of a tea bag. You know, the tea bags have little sayings on them. It says, be bold enough to own who you are. So this is my gift. This is what I'm here to do, to help other people heal their energy so that they can help heal the collective. Really, that's what's underneath all the work. That was the driving motivator of the book. That's what the welcome section of my book talks about, that healing our own personal pain has the power to heal the collective. So I'm going to be doing that. You know, I do it now in workshops and groups and stuff, but I'm going to be doing that one-on-one with people starting in the fall. So I think if I can help, you know, just one person, you know, just make their lives a little bit better, feel a little bit better, then they maybe will go out in the world and live their purpose, because that's what we're all here to do. That's what we're all here to do. And then we raise our frequency, and then the frequency of the earth raises, and things just naturally, organically get better, I think, hopefully.
Yeah. It's a good goal for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So the book was the catalyst for you being able to share, which kind of came naturally. And then now you're working toward doing more one-on-one instead of the group. Some of the modalities that you've mentioned, breathwork, sound healing, Reiki, EMDR, there's the somatic aspect. One of the things that you do or talk about is journaling as a way to release emotions. And tell me about your passion for journaling.
Yeah, I've always journaled probably since I got sober. It was suggested to journal, to get things out. And what happens for me when I journal, so I usually do all of this in the morning. I have a routine. I wake up. I have a meditation room. I call it the meditation cave in my basement. It's a small little room. I got like crystals and candles and signs and cards, oracle cards, and like all this stuff. I kind of have a process. I say this little like prayer that I've kind of patched together from different things that I've heard to just open me up to spirit or to my higher self, God, source, whatever you want to call it. And then I just kind of ask, okay, like what needs to be revealed, like, or what's bothering me, right? Like I just get very honest. Okay, well, somebody said something yesterday and that bothered me. Why did that bother me? Or I did this, I acted in this way and I didn't like that I did that. Why did I do that? So I just try and dig and dig and dig. And the journaling is really the way that I get to the solution. So I'll just be prompted, like I'll be praying or I'll be like meditating, I'll be listening, I'll be whatever, or I'll be inspired to like pick a card, or I just kind of like let go with the flow. I just kind of let go of like whatever my own direction, and I let something else guide me. And then I'll just hear like, okay, time to write, like take out, or I'll get like a nudge to like pull out my journal. And I usually start with like, or sometimes I'll even journal first. If I wake up and I'm like pissed about something, I'll just get it all out. Like I'll just like get it. I'll just be like, I can't believe this, you know? So like that's like one way of just like getting it all out. And then usually when I get to the end of it, I can see a little bit more clearly. Something kind of happens halfway through, or like I soften up, or I could really see the truth about what's going on. And it's just God, I believe, just kind of coming through me and then out my pen, and then I can see it on paper. And it's like, oh yeah, that's really what's going on here. But then if I meditate and all that first, then I will just journal like after that, like what I heard, what I felt, where I'm at. And it just, it's the whole process of the prayer, meditation, and the journaling that just brings these things up to the surface, you know? Mm. And then from there, I usually, at this point, I've been doing it so long, I just feel better. And I've actually started throwing in breath work. I start with breath work, and I do that for about 10 minutes, like a video, a patterned breath work. Holds, you know, breathing breath of fire, and then alchemizing, and then like holding, and that really like just shifts. So it resets your nervous system. And that's, I usually wake up not very happy. I don't know if it's because I dream a lot. I don't know what it is, but I wake up and I'm just like, maybe I'm just not a morning person. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I need something. I need to like get right like almost every single day. So that's what I do. And I kind of force myself. And then I also run. I exercise. That helps with the endorphins. And when I run, like when I got the download, I was going to write the book, something happens as well. Like I just start to see more clearly the truth of who I am and how I'm operating. And instead of blaming this one, and that one, I look inward and I say, what's my fear? Really? What's the fear? Any troubles that you have, there is a fear attached to it. That's the evil of the entire world, you know, like where it's just fear. Address the fear, ask God to remove it. So I kind of then weave in the 12 steps of my recovery program. Mm. So I'm kind of doing all of this like together, yeah. You know? So as I'm meditating, or as I'm thinking, or as I'm praying, or as I'm writing, I'm, you know, being willing to open up, which is like step two and three. And then, or one is, you know, life is unmanageable. Two and three is opening up. Four is getting really honest, putting pen to paper. And then sharing is another huge way to get to the truth of what's going on for you. Talking to other people that you trust and really listening. And when they say something, don't just blow it off. And don't just be like, for me, I could speak for me. They'll say something and my initial instinct will be like, no, that's not it. That's not, you know, no, I don't think so. But then it's like, all right, maybe like a few hours later or like a day later, I'm like, yeah, I think they're right. You know, so just pick the people that you share with like very wisely, and pick people who you know are going to tell you the truth, because the, you know, having people just co-sign your crap all the time is not going to help you grow like at all. So have people around you who challenge you. I have people who challenge me and make me think and make me really question, why did I do that? Why did I say that? You know, and then I can go and try to make it right. Right. Again, this is like step eight, nine, you know, making amends, or, you know, kind of cleaning up my side of the street so that I'm not walking around with this heavy burden of, or not liking myself, really the burden of just not liking myself, so that I can look in the mirror and say, you know what, you're okay. You know, you're better than okay. Yeah. You know, you're a good person, right? So my worth grows, my value grows, my self-love grows by trying to right the wrongs, because I'm going to mess up, definitely.
Yeah.
And just try to be a good person. And when I'm feeling something like in the moment, like try to like not do that, or try to shift it and change it and just kind of say, all right, you know, I say, fix my eyes, fix my ears. I say that a lot, you know, like help me to see clearly, like what's really going on here, and how can I just be a better human and just love more? It's all love, right? So fear is a problem and love is the answer all the time.
Yeah. I love that. And I think it's so powerful. On one of the things I say at the onset of the podcast, in the introduction, is that no matter your cultural upbringing, your faith practice, all of those, like grief affects us all. And what I think is so powerful as a thread line through all of the interviews or conversations I've had with others on the podcast is how powerful a connection to God, to, as you understand, is so incredibly transformative to the way that you grieve and the way that you will move forward in that grief. And I know there was a study, and I'll have to look it up, but because recalling this from my brain is difficult, but the study showed that those that had a faith practice of any kind of a belief in higher power, God, as you understand it, I know that's what the 12 step says.
Yes.
That made an increase by like 70% in the people who were able to come to a place of being able to move forward in life and had a higher risk of better health, better outcomes. And so just hearing you talk about that for you and being able to hear other people who have a different faith practice or different, that they're reaping some of this very similar benefits of being able to feel the benefits of prayer, feel the benefits of what that does for your nervous system, of introspection, and those tenets of which are across a lot of faiths. And I think that's really cool to see. And I love that you incorporate that in your work.
All about connection. It's all about connection. At the end of the day, it's about connection to self, to others, and to something greater. And the way that I really was able to connect to myself on such a deep and honest and loving level was by really inner child work. And I'm sure you've done it, or you've talked to people, you know, like, and that there are some great inner child meditations that I do, you know, that kind of stuff really got me to the place where it was like, okay, I deserve a good life and I can show up for myself because I'm showing up for my inner child. Big Amanda can take care of little Amanda, right? And I need to like do that first and get and feel safe. So you mentioned like, how do I feel safe? That's definitely one of the modalities of like, I feel safe because I went back and I healed where little Amanda didn't feel safe. Now Big Amanda takes care of little Amanda. So that was huge. And speaking of connection quick, connecting to something greater, but also keeping the relationship and the connection alive with your loved one is huge. You know, if you believe that, I think it's really helpful for a lot of people to believe that you know, energy just changes form, just like love. Love doesn't dissipate. It doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't evaporate when somebody dies. So it's about keeping that relationship alive with them in spirit, looking for signs or connection, whatever it is. That is also, that's been really, really helpful for me with healing my grief.
Yeah, that's so powerful. And my brain is going to this question. I keep coming back to it, so I'm going to ask it. Mm-hmm. When you were at that concert and you heard that song and you initially took it to mean, I need to get out of this marriage. But you made a comment about how that was the one song you kept turning off no matter what. You also mentioned that it was you and your brother's favorite band. I'm curious if you ever revisited why that song was getting turned off by you.
Yeah, it was probably just fear because, well, the truth is I loved my husband to the best of my ability at that time. I didn't really even know what love was. So I wasn't really even lying to myself. That line actually was not that incorrect. So it wasn't like I was even wrong in feeling that way because I didn't know what true love was. So she lies and says she's in love with him, can't find a better. I didn't even know how to love really. I loved based on what I thought love was and based on the experiences that I had, the role models, right? My environment, my family system, the way that we communicated, you know, just the dysfunction really. And it was true to some extent that not that I didn't love him. I loved him in the best way that I knew how, which was not real, true, wholehearted love and connection and closeness and purity. Like there was this like invisible shield between us where like I felt like
you couldn't be yourself fully.
Yeah. I felt like I couldn't be myself. Like I, and you know, Pearl Jam was a big part of that because when we first were together, so he's much older than me. Right. So like, that's more like my time, you know, Pearl Jam. So his time too, a little bit, but it was like, you know, he didn't like them or like he'd make fun of it that I was like stuck in the '90s or I was stuck in back in high school, whatever it was, you know, and like joking. Yeah. He didn't intend to make me feel bad, but I was so intent on getting my worth and my value through his approval that I took that to be like, oh, I'm not going to listen to Pearl Jam anymore. So I stopped listening to them for like 8 years. I didn't go to concerts. Yeah. I didn't do anything. And then like, it's interesting as his PTSD started to get really bad right before he really acknowledged it, I said, I'm going to a Pearl Jam concert in Chicago. That was in 2016. I was like, so it's interesting when I look back on it, that it was like, that was like the moment of where I kind of put my foot down. And I was like, no, I'm returning to my roots and I'm going back to who I am. And I don't really care what you think about it. Meanwhile, he didn't think anything about it. It was all in my head. Like most of this stuff is just all in my head. That's the crazy part about it. Oh my God. It wasn't really even that incorrect, but why I felt the way I felt because I didn't really know how to love.
Yeah. And I'm going to step on my own toes here, but could it possibly, and this is what I think of, you said you didn't know, you were loving him the best way you knew how, and then recognizing maybe the only one holding back, you being vulnerable and authentic with him in front of him, the only one that might have been preventing that was actually you, like your own willingness to say, oh, I've put this in my shadow and I want to be able to bring this back out. And this is important to me, is powerful because it's not surprising that literally that concert is the one you were in your rebellion.
Yes, it was total rebellion. And we were like in a fight on the way to the airport where we got into a fight. So like it just, it was just like, no, like I can't, I felt like I was like living a lie because I just couldn't like reach across because of, again, yes. And it mostly was from my doing, because he was always willing to like be there and love me. Like when my brother, when I was grieving hard those 3 months, he would come over to me and try and hug me and I would like pull away. So it wasn't like he wasn't willing to be there and be affectionate. You know, the majority of it was me. His PTSD played a little bit of a part, but you're very intuitive and insightful to see that. Yeah, that is true.
It's just the nature of relating when it's like so many times when I'm seeing it over and over again, that pattern, and being able to see what we think is our limiting belief where is really a mirror to what's going on internally and has so little to do with the people or external situations. They are impacted. It does impact. Our environment does impact. I'm not trying to say that. But a lot of times the reason why we are unable to move forward in that environment is more so because of our own, what's happening internally in response to that. So
Yeah. And then we set up environments like that to kind of foster that and make our limiting beliefs right and true.
Confirmation bias. Like, yeah. I just got to prove to you how right you were. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I said the same thing when you mentioned about, you know, the limiting belief or the belief that the world's not safe and everybody dies, everybody leaves. That's also a wounding that I have because of my early childhood trauma. And it's like, no, but I have the evidence. My little girl, inner little girl is going, no, wait, you've forgotten. I have receipts. So like, this is actually a legitimate fear. And in that moment, that realization that even as a 46-year-old woman heading in, like, I think I've started midlife, I am having to navigate those beliefs, even in this scenario, even though I've peeled that layer, you know, 5 years ago in divorce or before that at different, like, as you said, the layers keep coming toward facing those same beliefs over and over again in different aspects and times in our life.
I just had an experience with that like the other day. Like I was feeling like less than, or I was feeling judged, and nobody was really judging me. It was all in my head. Like you said, it's just, it's whatever's going on within me. And then my perception is clouded. You know, I'm wearing like these foggy goggles that I'm looking at life through, and I'm just seeing whatever it is I think about myself is being reflected back, because that's what I'm really looking for. Right. So yeah. But the evidence is not there to prove that. It's like, there's nothing to prove that. However, still to not discount that, to just say, you know what, that is how I feel. Yeah. Why do I feel that way? Validate it and say, what's going on? Why do I feel that way? And as we do peel that onion and different things, and we change and grow when things happen in life, right? Like stepping into like new successes or new areas or challenges or whatever it is, we're going to be confronted again with these same fears. Like they're so deep rooted, like they're so in there that it's not like you just do the work and then it's gone. I believe this is just like a lifelong kind of journey of, yes, we make progress 100%. I'm not the person I was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, even probably 6 months ago, I'm a different person. But like, it's that core thing that keeps coming up to show me, to teach me, to say, there's more here. There's more healing for you to do here.
Yeah.
So it's never just going to be over. The healing's never over.
No. No, it's not. And that's what I think is so powerful about working with people specifically, or wanting to talk about grief, like the work that you're doing, the podcast, that like trying to get that message out to everybody as medicine. Like, hey, you do not have to anticipate this to go away. You don't just heal this and expect it never to show up. And by the way, the time frame of that can be years. Like, it's the beauty of just explaining you have permission to grieve. Like, you have permission to let this affect you. You have permission to grow and go through the process as well. So, yeah.
That growth part is huge. I'm sorry, I just want to say really, really quick. Yeah. That growth part is huge. So it's not like, okay, well, I'm in this grief, I'm in this pain, and this is how I'm going to stay for the rest of my life.
Right.
You know, the big, big part of the message is like, no, like, yes, once you get through like the initial part, then how do you use your pain to motivate you to then step into this next part? But going through that, you have to be willing to look at all these things that come up, like we're talking about, as you're moving into that renewed life, that renewed purpose, and all of that. That's the goal of the grief. It's not just to stay in it because we feel guilty moving on, or we feel like we're betraying the person or whatever. It's okay, I can carry them with me. How do I integrate that loss into who I am, and then help just change me and make me grow into the next version of myself?
Yeah. Really. Yeah. That's beautiful. I love that.
I'm sorry.
No, that's a good. That was great. I love
that. It's a New York thing. I'm sorry.
You can jump in anytime. That is perfect. So, how can people find you? Where can they find you and work with you?
So I'm at Amanda McCoy Flanagan, McKoy Flanagan, on Instagram, on Facebook. It's the same thing for my website. Everything is Amanda McCoy Flanagan. My podcast is on Spotify, YouTube, Apple, everywhere that you listen to podcasts. That's called Soul Rising, SOL Rising, all in on Loveless and Connection. My website, I have all my events listed there. If you're interested in coming to my retreat, come out to beautiful Colorado. If you're not here, listen, if you're somewhere in the country, come on out. I mean, we're going to be at a hot spring. It's going to be an awesome, awesome weekend. And then once I have my grief coaching business launched and everything, and my other offerings, it'll also be on my website. So you could just follow me for now for those things.
That's
to work with me like on Zoom or something like that.
Yeah. And look for the individual coaching coming in the fall after Italy and lots of carbs and walking and crazy motorcycle drivers. Just if you can survive that, you can survive anything.
Yeah, I can't wait. Have you been to Italy?
I have. Yeah. I got to go to Rome and where else to? My brain. We traveled to a couple of different cities. It was Venice. It was beautiful. Mm-hmm. My takeaways were, wow, they eat really late. Like sit down for dinner at 9 o'clock and you're getting fresh food. So you're going to be there for a while. Yeah.
Okay.
Late nights, whole families at 9 o'clock at night around in a restaurant, just eating. Yeah. It was amazing. And then don't ask if you're Southern, which you're not going to have to worry about this, but don't go and ask for butter for your bread. That is a Southern thing.
Just olive oil.
Yeah, yep. That was a no-no. Don't ask for that. And that was one of my cultural. And then I found out, this is so, I'm telling on myself, but apparently chicken parmesan is not an Italian dish. So if you go there, the waiter literally looked at me and said, chicken is too easy. We don't do that. That's what he said.
Oh, that's funny. It's like too easy.
Chicken parmesan is American. That's not Italian. We don't do that.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
What kind of Italian am I?
Listen, he could be wrong and be spreading misinformation. And I, as the American, believed him. I'm like, okay, chicken parmesan. Okay, great. But yeah, that was the beautiful food, beautiful people. It was, everything was gorgeous over there. You're going to love it.
That's awesome. Yeah, I can't wait. I can't wait. It's going to be great.
Oh, well, thank you for being with me and for talking about your story and the work that you do. I'm so incredibly grateful I got to meet you, for sure.
Thank you, Rachel. It's an honor to be here. I appreciate it very much.
Yes, ma'am. All right, everybody. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next time.